Just so Kay and Jay and Dave, we have assigned several of the TAP members to be primary discussants to lead the discussion for each of these measures. And of the three folks who are at them, none of them are on the call yet, so we can't even begin to proceed. So if it looks like this is going to be a problem because of weather or whatever, we'll just have to see. I haven't received any. Hi there. Somebody join us? No. I haven't received any messages from Dr. Sursek or Dr. Kavner on that they wouldn't be able to join us. So, hello. Who's joined us? Hello.
This is Mike Rich.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm good.
Apparently, we're really slow to having people gather. We've only got three TAP members and none of the discussants for today so far. So we're
There's a long delay when you call in.
Okay.
I called in right around 11 our time.
Okay,
and
12,
they
right.
just put me in. So
It's
close to 10-minute delay.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, let's say at least 5.
Hi. Someone just joined us?
Hi, this is Sean O'Brien from Duke Clinical Research Institute.
Hi, Sean. It's Reva. How are you?
Hi, Reva. Doing well.
Great. Okay. Apparently, it's slow getting in, and we're still missing a large number of the committee members. Operator Lynn? Operator? You there? Lynn, are you there? Somebody just join us?
It's Joyce.
Oh, hi, Joyce.
How are you doing?
Okay. Apparently, there's a bit of a delay getting on the call, and we don't have but a handful of the committee members yet, so we're still waiting.
Yeah, I had trouble also. I don't know what happened.
Okay. Thanks. Hi, did somebody else just join?
Yeah. Hi, it's Lee Fleischer. Just listen in.
Okay. Thanks, Lee. We're slow gathering our committee members. We don't even have the primary discussants on the line yet, so. We're waiting.
Okay, then I'm going to go to mute since I'm just really listening.
Thank you. Somebody can join us?
Yes, this is Rich Prager.
Oh, good, Dr. Prager. How are you?
I'm all right. I made it.
Hey, Rich, I owe you some information. It's Lee. I'll get back to you.
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much, Lee. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Reva, this is Sean O'Brien. Is there a webinar part of this meeting?
Sarah, do you have the webinar set up?
Yes, set up. Mm-hmm.
No, I didn't register for the meeting, so I don't have the information.
Okay.
Do you have the agenda?
I do, yeah.
Okay, if you just right-click and click on the hyperlink, it will let you register and send you an email right back.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So is Dr. Sursek with us? Or Dr. Katzen? Okay. There are two of the discussants for the measures today. Dr. Prager, did you experience a long time getting from the time you called in to getting answered?
No, about a minute.
Oh, you were okay.
Yeah, just about a minute.
Delay.
That's all.
I'm sorry. Somebody just join us. Hi. Did somebody just join us?
For Dr. Sursek, hold on, please.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello?
Hello, Dr. Sursek. How are you?
Okay, good morning. Thank you.
Sure, thank you. Okay, it looks like we've got several of the larger number of the TAP members here. Let me just run the roll quickly. Dr. Gibbons is not able to be with us today, so I will be facilitating the call. This group has been through this process before, so I think you'll pretty much be able to manage yourself. Dr. Al-Khatib is here. Dr. Sursek is here. Dr. Crouch has said he'll be late. Dr. Ellis is here. Hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, Dr. Ellis? Great.
Yes.
Dr. Katzen with us? Irene, did you join us? No. Okay. Dr. is here. Dr. Sadawi? No, and Dr. Spindler. Okay. Just because we're fairly well into our time, I'd like to go ahead and at least get started on the measures, because we do have two of the three discussants with us. I just want to remind everybody that we are recording this call, and that the recording of this call will be posted on our website, so please be aware of that. So we do have five of our CAP members, and in addition, on the line, we have representatives of the major developers. From Ingenix is Kay Schwebke. From STS is Jane Hahn, Dave Sheehan, and Sean O'Brien. From the steering committee is Joyce DeBow and Lee Fleischer, the co-chairs, listening in. Is there anyone else listening in? Okay. Then it's Sarah Fantov and myself from NQF. So thank you all for being here. I know the weather is a real issue for folks. What I'd like to do is reverse the order of the measures on the agenda, simply because Dr. Katzen was one of the discussants for measure 021012, and I'm still hopeful that she might be able to join us. And so why don't we go ahead and start with 021-01309, which is the STS cabbage composite score. Both Dr. Prager and Dr. Sursik have evaluated that measure, and interestingly enough, your evaluations were identical and scored it highly on all of the subcriteria. So perhaps we could just go through them briefly, and each of you could add your comments on why you scored it as you did. So,
should I start?
Sure. Why don't you go ahead, Dr. Sursik, and start. The first criteria are the 1D and 1E around the composite.
Yeah, 1D, 1E. I would say, you know, I would go ahead and say that this is one of the measures, the best one that I, you know, this my short membership here, I reviewed is the best tested, actually implemented. The results have been already distributed to some users, I mean the providers, and there is extensive publications of the measure, so this is the one that's really, in my mind, the most advanced that I've seen, and that's why I scored it the highest on across the board, because to me it's really established by now. So 1D is the purpose of object of the composite. I gave it a highest. I think it's there. It's well established. It's a combination of the four measures. I can quote them. This is the use of the internal mammary artery. Is the perioperative use of beta blockade, discharge beta blockade, antiplatelet agents, and lipid lowering agents. It's all or none measure, and it's extensively discussed while it's all or none, and it's not sort of going to use separately one versus the other because of the issues of assessing that and reporting. Then risk-adjusted operative mortality and risk-adjusted post-operative morbidity, which means like post-operative stroke, renal failure, ventilation, prolonged ventilation, re-exploration, deep sternal wound infection, is again all or none measure. It's extensive discussion, even the publications, why it's all or none. And the providers, the groups, hospitals, or individual will be then sort of rated as a 1, 2, or 3 stars. I mean, 1 below average, 2 average, and 3 above average. So as I said, the purpose of objective composite is well established. It's new, so I gave it an H at the highest.
Okay.
Same for conceptual construct of quality. There is two publications. I think all the members have gotten copies, at least 2 or 3 of them, in which there is an extensive discussion of the concepts and of this for quality. So I gave it an H again.
Okay. Thank you. I just want to break in for a minute. Did I hear someone join us? Did somebody just beep in?
Yes. My name is Rachel Dokhodan. I'm with the Duke Clinical Research Institute.
Great. Okay, Rachel. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's the section under importance for this 2Hs.
Yeah.
Dr. Prager, any comments?
No, I concur. And
okay.
I gather since we scored it correctly, since we scored it identically, I basically agree with everything Doctor said.
Okay, great. All right, so we'll move down to the section on scientific acceptability of the measure properties. Realize this is you know, in the composite submission form. So you've rated all of these criteria as high.
Yeah, because you know one can raise issues that the you know that you combine them, that you use all or none, and that there might be some gradation in the importance of a certain measure. But that's been extensively discussed, validated, and tested in this publication. So I still think you know they tried out, they did the statistical analysis if they would use separate, if there would be any significant difference. There was none. So that's why I went ahead and gave it all H, you know, across the board.
And you feel that the measure can provide meaningful differences?
Oh, yes, I just certainly do.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's an H across. Dr. Prager, any comments from you?
No.
Okay. Same sort of thing. The submission materials are rather detailed, and I think they will provide any of audience members
the answers to all this, because in the publications that are provided to you, that it's all there. I mean, it's
right.
Well discussed and it's been peer reviewed and published. So this is really as good as it gets.
Okay.
This is Steve Ellis from Med. Can I interject one question? And it may reflect my ignorance as not being a surgeon, but where's the data supporting the use of beta blockers post-op? I'm not aware of any randomized trial suggesting that that's a good thing to do.
Well, I think that there are a number, Dave Sheehan, there are a number of studies attesting to the value of postoperative or discharge beta blockade in terms of arrhythmia prophylaxis. I think probably more from observational studies and randomized clinical trials, although I believe some of the former exist. I thought you were going to ask about preoperative beta blockade. That is actually, although an individually endorsed NQF measure, one that we're going to be looking at going forward because of the change that has taken place in the non-cardiac surgery world in terms
right.
of...
With poise and the like. So arrhythmia suppression, yes, but if the patient's not had an arrhythmia in hospital, there's a reason to put the patient on beta blockers post the time of discharge?
Well, we see, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on early discharge with these patients, and I think some of the patients that previously might have stayed in the hospital 7 or 10 days and had their atrial fibrillation noticed in hospital and treated may now be going home early, and you may not have an opportunity to observe that. So I think that would be my rationale for that.
I don't want to belabor the point. So what's the level of evidence on it by ACC? I just don't want to see us endorsing things that aren't very scientifically valid. And again, it may reflect my ignorance. I just don't know that this is that well scientifically supported.
I would point out the fact that all 11 of the individual measures that compose the composite have gone through the NQF endorsement process. They're all individually endorsed, and I think you can refer back to the original documents in the consensus, voluntary consensus cardiac surgery, which will probably have that evidence. I don't happen to have it at my fingertips.
And frankly, in the measurement maintenance that may have either come up last year or is coming up, and I suspect, Steve, the references are in there, so we can those.
Yeah. I was just going to say, this is Rita. I think we can collect those references
right.
and address your question, Dr. Ellis, just probably not right this second. But I certainly follow up on that.
If you could follow up, and then I'll be quiet on the issue.
Not a problem. We can do that. Any other comments from anyone else on any other CAP members on the scientific acceptability of this composite measure? Have any other CAP members joined us that I haven't acknowledged? Has Dr. Katzman joined us? No. Okay. All right. So those are rated high. So on the third section on usability, again, Dr. Sirsik and Dr. Prager, you've rated this highly on all the criteria. Would you like to just kind of...
This is what be... Which on one? You're on three?
Three, usability.
Let me just a second. Yeah, because this has been in use, the data has been collected and has been already provided to the individual, you know, centers and groups that have provided the data, and the feedback was very positive that it's very helpful. So from that aspect and from this feedback for the 2 years, I gave it an H, that's why.
All right, Dr. Prager, any comments?
No, I would agree. The only issue, and this shows my naivete about composites, I'm not sure we have enough composites out there, so I think there may have to be a broader understanding of composite metrics, all or none, in general, if this for the public, per se, or the broad group of consumers. But I think that's in evolution as well.
All right. Thank you for that comment. Any other comments from TAP members? Okay. So we'll go on to the last
feasibility
group of sub-criteria, and that's under feasibility. And again, both of the reviewers ranked it highly on all of the sub-criteria. Dr. Sirsik, comments?
Yeah, this is a database, in my understanding, which it's a clinical data set. So this is really, you know, in comparison to administrative, which we discussed last time. So I think this is a, you know, it's much stronger data set. And there is also some percent relook at the data. So some that there is some control that the reported data, you know, at least percent of it is sort of validated. So I think this in my mind is the best data set that I've come across, you know, from about this outcome. So that's why I gave it an H.
All right. Gregor, any other comments?
The database is audited, and so I think it has considerable strength and will actually gain more strength because of that.
Okay. All righty. So essentially, if any other of the TAP members disagree with rating it as Dr. Sirsik and Dr. Prager have done, rating it highly on all the sub-criteria? Dr. Rich, any comments? Dr. Ellis?
No, I agree with the point that Dr. Ellis made earlier, which you're going to follow up on.
Right.
You know, regarding the pre-op beta blockade, I think that this is also not as strong as one might like, but I think that there is reasonably good evidence, first of all, in the preoperative period that patients with active coronary disease benefit from beta blockers, but also in terms of prophylaxis against perioperative atrial fibrillation, I think there's reasonably good data. So I'm less concerned about the pre-op beta blocker than the post-op beta blocker.
Okay. All right. So we will follow up with the evidence that we have from prior review of that individual measure, and I'll share that with everybody on the TAP.
This is Dr. Al-Khatib. One thing I would add is that, you know, as all of us are aware, many of these patients who undergo CABG actually have approved indications for beta blockers in general. I mean, a lot of them have a reduced LVEF. Many of them are status post-MI. So, I mean, although I am not actually aware, I'm not a surgeon, but I'm not aware of any clinical trials randomizing patients to beta blockers versus not peri-CABG. I'm not sure that those trials can even be done because, you know, I would say the majority of these patients have other approved indications for beta blockers.
All righty. Anybody else want to add anything in the discussion of this? Anything about the composite and the way it's presented or combined?
No, I mean there were issues raised about this composite, but there are two publications added in which these issues are extensively discussed and tested, and that answers all my concerns, especially all or none, right? But they've been added and tested, so I think to me I don't have anything further to add.
All right. Okay. Well, if we're finished with that one, if there are no other comments, we'll try and go on to the second one. The measure for discussion today is OT10-0209. That's coronary artery bypass graft procedure in postoperative stroke during the hospitalization or within 7 days of discharge. This is a measure from Ingenix. And Dr. Prager and Dr. Katzen were the reviewers. And I'm sorry, Dr. Katzen's not on the line. I do have her evaluation and comments, so I will try and just jump in there as we go through this to just report what she has said. Dr. Prager, I think it's going to then go to you.
Okay, I'll start. And unfortunately, I was not going to be in my office. I have a paper copy that doesn't have colors. You'll have to remind me where the yellow is so I can go. But under the...
Importance
to measure and report. I actually gave it a partial, but that... not because it's not a very important measure. I believe it's a critical measure to measure and report. It was somewhat because of the statement that the age grouping in this group had the majority of patients were under age 65.
Okay.
And that excludes a considerable number of patients who have coronary artery bypass grafting.
Actually, Reeve, if I could just correct that. The measure does look at patients over the age of 65. It's just that the extensive testing database that we have, unfortunately, is very limited in having patients over the age of 65. So the measure includes
okay.
that. It's just our testing database is really very limited with that population.
Okay. All right. Well, that helps. Then I have no problem giving it a C.
Okay, on all three of the criteria?
Yes.
Okay, I'm just looking at Dr. Katzen's comments, and she has mentioned something in terms of other data to describe the high impact and would recommend using the 3.1% rate of stroke type 1 CNS deficits after CABG. She also felt the justification in this area would be stronger if data on the variability in CVA rates by providers or hospitals would help understand the usefulness of the measure. And I think that's pretty much what she had. She rated 1A as a C, 1B as a P, and 1C as a P. So,
and I originally had 1B as a P.
Okay, opportunity for improvement.
Yeah.
Because
I had that originally
know
as a
for
P.
Sure. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I'll go back to that. And then the evidence, I would actually agree with that.
Okay. All righty. So basically, you're going to rate 1A as a C, 1B as a P.
P and P.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Any other comments from any other members of the TAP on this particular?
Yeah, just one question, Mr. Mikrich, regarding this issue of including patients over the age of 65, and maybe the person who spoke earlier could just clarify this. If it's not something that's readily available for your testing, is it something that's going to be readily available for the users? Even if we include, I'm talking about inclusion of the patients over the age of 65, and as somebody mentioned earlier, that's actually, at the present time, more than half of CABG patients are 65 or older, and that certainly is a higher risk group for perioperative stroke and other neurological complications as well.
Yeah, this is Kay Schwebke from Ingenix. I can certainly address that. This is information customers would have. The reason that our test database is limited is because our test database tends to be composed of data that's coming in from a geographically variable group of commercial providers. And so that's why, you know, we do have some patients over the age of 65, but truthfully it's so small, I don't even want to think of it as being representative of the elderly population in this country. However, customers... certainly have access to that data. And I will just say we are making efforts to try to get a more representative kind of sample from that population so that we can include this with future testing information.
I would think that data is available in the STS database as well, just as one mechanism for acquiring that data. I think that this point really doesn't impact on the importance to measure and report issue. It clearly is important to measure and report. Maybe we'll have some impact on some of the other scientific and feasibility issues.
Anybody else?
But I'm comfortable with it.
Any other comments from TAP members on the importance of
sub-criteria?
Okay, why don't we move on to the second section on scientific acceptability. I think we do need to go through these one by one. So the first one is the precision of the specifications. Dr. Prager, what did you...
I actually gave this a C.
Uh-huh. Okay. This is based on administrative data, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
But understanding that, and it's from multiple sources, which I'm not sure I understood till today, so it's different commercial providers, and you know, I guess I would say that I'm a little more uncomfortable based on hearing that today.
Okay.
And would probably rank take it down a notch to partial.
Okay. Well, Dr. Katzen has ranked it as a partial as well, and her comments for 2A are that many of the ICD-9 code sets include 433.x0, which typically denote artery occlusions without infarct. The accuracy of these codes for detecting stroke is problematic. Even more importantly, sensitivity and specificity of stroke detection after open heart surgery likely varies according to the fastidiousness of physicians and practice patterns. Studies of perioperative stroke has demonstrated higher rates of stroke when neurologists are involved. And also in 2A, she commented that pre-op strokes are not affected by the quality of the open heart surgery. Open heart surgery may still be necessary even if a patient is unstable. And then a question on the denominator statement, why age 20 is used instead of age 18. Hello. And then another comment asking to clarify why excluding patients who died after CABG are excluded. They died from a stroke is her question.
I mentioned that later as well.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't.
Yeah, so...
Mm-hmm.
So these were just her comments. Another exclusion were exclude patient the discharge date occurred during the 7 days prior to the report period and end date or on or after the report period end date. I think she wasn't sure what that meant. So I think there was some she was requesting some clarification in some of the specifications.
Before, if we have Ingenix get involved now, but I think one of the realities, and in the scientific evidence, it depends on, obviously, fastidiousness is a great word, but the FDS database, for example, is anywhere from 1.1 to 1.3% over the last several years for a postoperative cerebrovascular accident during the hospitalization, fact one. But other literature has it higher. So I'm not sure we know a number, and it may be based on which codes are pulled, which codes aren't pulled. And so I think that starts to become an issue when you do use multiple coding systems that pull out these numbers. Again, I think that basically is an issue with this because we're going, no matter who we cite, depending on what their background and approach was, we're going to have a different percentage in this. And it may be that they look at it differently, did different tests, or code it differently. So
yeah, this is Steve Ellis, and I'm reflecting on the carotid endarterectomy and carotid stenting experience where this issue of fastidiousness is incredibly important, that the rate of neurological events is double or triple if you have a neurologist examine the patient both before and afterwards. So the more careful you are, the more penalized you're going to be because your outcomes are going to look worse. I think this is a major problem of comparability of ascertainment.
All righty. Any other comments from anyone? All right, so let's move on down to the next sub-criteria, which is the reliability testing. Dr.
Reva, do you want me to address any
of I'm sorry, Kay, you're right. That would probably be a good idea.
I just didn't want to jump in and approach
it. No, that's fine, good.
I think that administrative claim certainly has its limitations. There's no doubt about this. I would say that this is probably where administrative claims is at the strongest point, where it's picking up severe types of diagnoses like stroke, where you would hope that the coding error would be smaller than some of the other diagnoses. But you're right. You know, junk in, junk out, and good input, good information out. So it is going to be highly dependent. But the beauty of it is it certainly allows us and it allows customers to look very efficiently at a large population that potentially could be having complications that may be preventable in the future if we could really find those places or their providers and help them change some of their practices. As far as some of the other subtleties in the specification, when we built this measure, we did build it based on the original STS measure that was endorsed by NQF. So things like excluding patients who died, the age threshold of 20, those were actually part of the original STS specification, and because we knew that was put together with very thoughtful intent, we had no reason to vary from it. Now, the newer version of this STS measure is now a CMS PQRI measure. It's measure 166, and that now includes a different age group, 18 rather than 20. It does still include excluding patients who have died, and it does have a different CABG code set. So just so you're aware, that was kind of the origin, and we will be updating our condition actually this year based on the most recent, the 2010 CMS PQRI specification. So hopefully that addresses some of the major concerns.
Well, I think it still doesn't address the issue of the carefulness of the examination and the penalization for hospitals who are more careful. And I wish that Dr. Katzen, who's a neurologist, could comment, but I wish she's not on the call.
Yeah. And you mean specifically the coding accuracy?
Well, first it's the clinical. The first problem is the variation in clinical diagnosis. If you look carefully, you're going to have a much higher percentage of neurologic events than if you just rely on, cursory exam, which is the way it's usually done. And then there's the secondary problem, the coding issue. But I was actually more addressing the clinical issue, the variation in the diagnosis, depending on how carefully one looks.
Now, that issue won't be any different compared to the CMS PQRI measure that's already endorsed.
I don't care if it's endorsed or not, quite honestly. I'm just offering up my own opinion.
This is Mike Rich. Can I ask for a clarification on the supplemental document that you set out about the NQF-endorsed CABG measures? Number 131 is stroke or cerebrovascular accident within 72 hours. And, I know this one extends to up to 7 days post-discharge. And I'm a little concerned that whether or not this is going to really add anything beyond the existing measure. And so perhaps some clarification on how this is differentiated from the existing measure.
Well, I think, Mike, I think this is not unlike the question you asked last time about other measures that have a lot of similarities. Basically, what we're asking you all to do is look at the sub-criteria for this particular measure. It is similar to an already endorsed measure that's undergoing constant review, and we will be putting them side by side and asking the steering committee to look at their the relative, additive value. Is do we need two measures? Do they provide different information? At this point, we need you just to assess the characteristics of this particular measure.
So this measure completely subsumes the existing measure, basically.
Okay.
So anybody who has a stroke within 72 hours is, by definition, going to have had it within 7 days of hospital discharge, right?
Okay.
So, okay.
Right, that's a comment that we can put.
Yeah. So I guess the obvious issue, which you guys will have to decide, is which of these two. I mean, it seems to me that you don't need both, but which of the two is the better?
Okay.
One for this purpose.
All righty. Well, the first step is to go through each of these sub-criteria
right.
To help us
I understand.
Pull those out. So, Okay. Anything? Any other comments on specifications? Okay. Why don't we move then on to the reliability testing, Dr. Prager?
Okay. Reliability testing based on their data sample, understanding administrative databases and things. I actually gave it a C.
Okay. Yeah, Dr. Katzen gave it a P. Okay. Her comment was the reliability testing result describes the rate of this measure in a large data set but does not provide reliability statistics. So in her view,
okay.
So how would you like to come down on the final?
I think that's a legitimate explanation.
Okay. All righty. Any other comments from other CAP members on that sub-criteria?
No.
Okay. 2C is the validity testing. Dr. Prager, where did you end up on that?
I actually gave that a C as well.
Okay. Dr. Katzen gave it an M.
Uh-oh.
Okay. She says the face validity is okay, but the validity study looked at more than 700 data elements in only 100 charts. It does not specifically report the results for stroke after CABG. If the rate of stroke is only 3 to 7%, this may not be enough testing.
Okay, I thought they had. Okay, then I misread it. All right.
So where do you want to...
Well, I would downgrade anything. Can Ingenix help us on that a little bit?
Hey, any comments?
This is testing information as chart review is, of course, data that we don't have access to, so it was information provided to us from a customer. So I would need to go back to that customer and see if what kind of data they might still have specifically on this measure.
Well, then I would downcode it, too.
All righty. Where do you want to land, a P or an M?
M.
Okay. We'll do. But possibly K could give us some more data.
Correct.
Okay, thanks. All right, the next one is 2D, the exclusions. And Dr. Prager, what did you... You said an A, right?
Yeah, I did. Well, and again, I had the confusion about the age.
Okay.
And I also have the confusion about dying of a stroke in the hospital, but I addressed that in comments later as well.
Okay. Dr. Katzen rated it as an N for that particular reason.
Oh, okay. Well, if that's where that's most appropriate for that reason, then I would actually rate it an N, too.
Okay.
That's where the exclusion goes for age and mortality from stroke.
All right. Kay, any comments about why or what about patients dying of a stroke?
Why we excluded them?
Yeah.
Again, that was based on us wanting to follow as closely as we could an already endorsed measure, where we were just trying to make that measure more operational by using administrative claims data.
Right.
And we gave great faith to the fact that this was already a measure that had been reviewed and that seemed to be appropriate.
Yeah.
If people wanted us to remove that exclusion, we could certainly do so.
Is Dave Sheehan still on the line?
Yes.
Is there anybody from STS? I just want to... Yes?
Yes.
Oh, Dave, good. I'm going to ask you if... I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit for representing STS. And have in terms of the STS measure of stroke after CABG, I checked just really quickly that the exclusions do exclude patients who die. And what are your thoughts on this, patients who are dying of a stroke?
Yeah, we are embarking on a process of looking at every single one of our data elements, and I think that's one that we should think about because I think one could argue that you don't want to lose that group of patients who have the most negative outcome after a stroke. So, yeah, I think that's a legitimate concern.
Okay. All right. Any other comments on exclusions for this measure? Okay. Certainly, I'll make a note of that in terms of the ongoing review and maintenance of the STS measure for that particular issue. Kay, are you in a position to perhaps, are you able to actually identify the cause of death, separate death from stroke from other causes using administrative data?
That's a great question. It would be an assumption.
Okay.
We could certainly see through claims codes that are being submitted prior to a death, but that doesn't necessarily tell us that we know what the actual cause of death was.
Yeah. Okay.
So for something like that, we'd actually need information from a death certificate.
Right. Okay. So that's. Any other comments on those issues from anyone?
Yes, okay. Lee. Having done that, I don't see how you could look at cause of death from claims.
Oh, Lee, is that you?
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't feel comfortable.
Okay. All righty. Let's see. So we're moving on to the next subcriteria 2E, which is risk adjustment. And both, and Dr. Prager, you raised...
There was no information about any ability or creation of a risk adjustment mechanism.
Okay, and Dr. Katzen also rated it an N, saying, I believe risk adjustment is necessary. The occurrence of stroke is affected by age, ascending arch atheroma, presence of carotid stenosis, and so does require risk adjustment. So any comment from the major developer?
For this specific measure, we do not build into the specification any risk adjustment. Certainly, if people are using other tools like groupers, which typically happens, typically what happens when people use our measures is they're using a grouper along with some kind of quality measure, and the grouper then provides the ability to risk adjust. We don't actually do that in the measure itself.
So the measure itself is not risk adjusted. Okay.
Correct.
Any other comments or questions people like to make about risk adjustment for this measure?
This is Dr. Al-Khatib. I actually think that it needs to be risk-adjusted.
I support that, yeah. Buoyant Surfix.
Okay. So, in other words, the TAP supports the rating of an N for this, doesn't meet the criteria?
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Sounds good. All right. We'll go on to subcriteria 2F, which is meaningful differences. The results of this measure providing meaningful differences. Dr. Prager, your comments?
I gave it I think I checked off an M for minimally met simply because one, not risk-adjusted, two, not able to discern factors, techniques, approaches utilized, and that's why I gave it a minimal.
Okay. Dr. Katzen rated it an N also, though I don't see a specific comment to explain her rating. So I can leave it at your M. Any other comments from anyone else? Okay. Then we're moving on to 2G, which is comparability with multiple data sources. This one, I don't think this is done through administrative data, so probably isn't an applicable.
Not applicable.
Yeah. So 2H is the last one in this group, and that is disparities of care, and have disparities been addressed if they're known to be an issue with this particular topic area?
I did not see that they were addressed explicitly in this at all. I gave it an M. It could potentially be an N.
Okay.
I didn't see it.
Any comments from the measure developer?
Reva, what part of the application are you referring to now?
The 2H, disparities in care. Are there known disparities in this topic area, and if so, how does the measure address them?
Yeah, I would say this is not applicable. We don't have the ability with claims data to be evaluating confidently disparities in care. what customers can do is they certainly can identify geographic variation, and then they can look at information they might have to identify disparities in care. But at a high level, we're not certainly able to do that or to test that.
Okay. Any other comments on that? All right, so that finishes up all the sub-criteria for the scientific acceptability. So we will move on to the usability section for this measure. And I'm just looking here. 3A is whether it provides meaningful, understandable, and useful information. Dr. Prager, how did you...
Without understanding the multiple administrative databases I had to see, but I would downgrade that to a P or an M, actually.
Okay. All righty. Dr. Katzen rated it a P, but there's really no specific comment to explain it. So your P, I think, wins the day. Anybody else have any comments?
Reba, I'm a little bit concerned there might be some misunderstanding of administrative claims data.
Okay. Did you want to give a brief you'd like to say?
Well, maybe I could go back to the individual who just spoke, and I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Yeah, this is Rich Prager.
Yeah, Rich, could you just explain to me why you were thinking it was first based on earlier?
You broke up. Could you just say that again? I lost half of what you said.
Could you just restate why, based on earlier comments, you felt it was important to actually decrease the level of evaluation?
Well, or not so much earlier comments, but the fact that it's not just one administrative database, it's flow into a common source from multiple administrative databases.
Okay, so that's what I was concerned
about. Which raises some concern in my mind.
Yeah, I think there is some confusion between what we're providing through our testing database and what happens in real life. So when I was referring to multiple commercial entities that are putting information into a database, that's simply the information we use for testing our measures. That's very different from real life, where all of that information will go specifically to a health plan. So if it's a member, for example, who's, let's say a Blue Cross Blue Shield of some state is using this measure, they will have the claims for that patient, and all of that information will then go into their health plan database against which they can run this measure. So we're really talking about an individual. I mean, an individual patient is kind of the unit of analysis here, and that individual's claims are going to their health plan, and then that health plan can use this measure to see whether or not there was a complication after a CABG. But that's very, very different from what I said earlier, which is, but then we get to our testing database when we're trying to evaluate how this measure is working, what the compliance rate is. That's where we then have lots of different customers who are feeding data into a very geographically variable large data set. So hopefully that distinction makes a little bit more sense.
Yeah, that does help.
Okay. So, Dr. Prager, and where do you want to land your evaluation on the 3A subcriteria?
P.
I'm sorry?
P.
Thank you. I've got that. P. All right. Any other comments from anybody else on the tap? Okay, then the next subcriteria is 3B, relationship to other endorsed measures. I think we've talked about the fact that we do have an endorsed STS measure that is similar. The question is harmonization. There are some questions about harmonization that have already been raised. How did you, Dr. Prager?
Well, because of the discussion now, it's a P it's a P. I mean, the STS is moving as well.
Okay.
Time, so I'm not, we've raised the question, but the already endorsed measure hasn't moved yet.
Okay. We've identified harmonization issues for both measures. All right. And 3C, distinctive or additive value. What's your...
Well, I said, Pia, in the big picture, I would need help understanding how this is additive to the measure you already have.
Right. I think that I've heard several of you raise the question of whether it would, and what we're going to be doing is putting a side-by-side together of the two measures to compare their various characteristics for the steering committee to ultimately make that decision.
And Reva, when you do that, it might be helpful to know how many providers have actually reported to CMS PQRI on this measure. Because really the main incentive for us to have created this measure was to really operationalize a measure that we thought was unfortunately being underreported because it was so dependent upon a registry option and Category 2 codes.
Okay. The other issue is it's not just CMS's PQRI, but the measure is done through the STS database and feedback to those participants. So we can certainly find out what the current data of participation is in both of those programs.
This is Mike. I'd like to raise one other issue about this. The proposed measure looks at incident stroke within 7 days of hospital discharge, and obviously the length of stay is variable, and so that the duration of the window might be anywhere from less than 2 weeks postoperatively to 3 months postoperatively in an individual who had a particularly protracted and complicated postoperative course. And it seems to me that there should be some standardization of this. This issue came up also, I think, when we met in D.C., and perhaps a fixed time period, for example, 30 days within the procedure would be more suited. I'm interested in further comment about that.
And this is Rich Prager. I would add to that, my read of this says this measure starts with the date of admission, which to me, one could read it as implying that's the date of the operation as well. And that's not necessarily correct. So that also opens the front end of this to a time frame issue.
I think those are great comments. Again, when we built this, we did try to duplicate the STS specification, but that is certainly something that we could modify our measure, where if the desire was to reduce that variability by identifying the date of the procedure and then looking 7 days out for the complication, we could certainly do something like that.
Yeah, hey, this is Irene Katz, and I'm so sorry I was late because of a patient emergency, but I totally agree that it should be, we should take it from the date of the surgery.
Thank you, Irene.
One more quick comment on this is with respect to the current measure, which is looks at only the 72-hour window. In my opinion, that's too short of a time period. So I think that extending that to 7 days or 30 days or some other time period, I would be supportive of that.
Yeah. Mike, I just wanted to go back. I was looking at that this morning, too, and my reading of the spec is that it's the percent of patients undergoing CABG who develop a post-operative neurologic defect persisting greater than 72 hours. So to me, that isn't the window. That's part of the diagnostic criteria of what gets you in the numerator.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, and so that was a question I had, was what is the time window? And Dave Sheehan, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Can I impose upon you again? Can you clarify? Do you know?
That is correct. That is the duration, and that's also something, you know, the whole issue of the stroke is in evolution. Things that, for example, used to be called TIAs, we now know that a significant proportion of those, if you do MRI, are truly strokes. Do we want to insist on an MRI criterion for any patient, for example, who has a TIA in the postoperative period. These are things that we're struggling with, and I suspect that this particular measure will undergo evolution during the next month when we have our specification upgrade.
Oh, so it's your specification upgrade is actually happening that quickly?
It's happening in 2 weeks.
Okay. Is that for all of these measures?
That's for every data element in the STS database.
Okay. We need to regroup with STS then on all of these. But do you happen to know the time window for the stroke in relationship to the CABG surgery that qualifies for the STS?
Right now, the only complication that we record after hospital discharge is sternal infection, and that's because sternal infection is something that can kind of smolder and not be clinically evident until sometimes days, 2 weeks after surgery when the patients are home. So we do have a 30-day window on that. We do not for the other complications, first of all, because most of the strokes that we're interested in collecting are the ones that occur immediately postoperatively. Now, if somebody goes home in 2 weeks and goes into atrial fibrillation and has a stroke, I think that's of interest. But we are currently not collecting it. It's actually very, very difficult to collect accurate 30-day data.
Right.
And we've not gone that route with anything other than sternal infection at this point. And
great.
Most
thanks
of the
for letting me impose on you. Then that just brings up the question to Ingenix. Why did you pick your 7-day window post-discharge? Did I lose Kay?
Sorry, I was on mute. I would need to go back and look at the history because I don't remember offhand if the original STS specification defined the 7-day period. I know the current PQRI does not, so I would need to get back to you on that one.
Okay. Dr. Katzen, any thoughts in terms of the time window from your perspective?
Yeah, I do think that the timing should start at the time of CABG, and the point is well taken that after discharge, the ascertainment might be incomplete, so it could potentially be up to the time of discharge. I think that that's probably a very cogent thing to include.
I think that it does cause some potential inconsistency, though, because if the person has a stroke 2 weeks after the CABG, in one case the person might have gone home and developed atrial fibrillation, had a stroke. The other situation, the person could develop atrial fibrillation, still be in the hospital and have a stroke at 14 days. And so in one case it would count, and in another case it wouldn't, even though it's occurring at the same time after the CABG. So I understand the difficulty of collecting the data, but it would be valuable, I think, to try to rectify that problem.
Okay. I think these are comments that both measure owner developers are able to take back.
Yep, very helpful comments.
This is Dave Sheehan again. I just wanted to note that our data element number 2830 is complications, neuro, permanent stroke, and definition that has now been in use for several years, which will be reevaluated, is indicate whether a patient has a postoperative stroke that did not resolve within 24 hours. So just to make that clear.
So there has been a revision since.
Yeah. So I think that what you're going from was a previous definition from the previous version 2.5
okay.
That was sequence number 2840, where recovery was within 72 hours. So I think we've actually said anything over 24 hours is a permanent stroke.
Okay. All righty. So in hospital. Okay. All righty. Any further comments on that? Because I think that's the section on usability. So then our last section we need to do is the feasibility, and that's the discussion of how feasible it is, how is the data abstraction, use of electronic data. So 4A is the how the data generated as a byproduct of care processes. Dr. Prager, how did you rate that?
I actually rated it a C.
Yeah, so did Dr. Katzen. Any comment from either of you or anyone else?
I have none.
Okay. B, 4B is electronic sources. Are all the data elements available electronically?
I gave it a C.
Both of you have C. Any comments from either of you? Okay. 4C is exclusions. Do the specified exclusions require additional data sources beyond what is required for the numerator and denominator specifications? You both have rated it a C. Any comments from anyone? Okay. 4D is susceptibility to inaccuracies, errors, or unintended consequences. And you both rated that as a P. Could you kind of give us your thoughts?
I put it as a P, and I'm thinking about what, frankly, based on the administrative sources and death in house from that may have been precipitated by CVA and not including these patients as well.
Okay. Dr. Katzen?
Yeah, I agree. I guess there are two main things is, one, you might have, I know you already reviewed the ICD-9 codes that were used, but I find that some of them are more or less specific to stroke, and that could cause a problem. But the main thing that I know from the neurologic point of view, we have a tough time with any registry data that uses stroke as a complication using administrative data, is that the accuracy is only as good as the fastidious of the specialty. So there are some hospitals that are going to be very careful about doing an exam, et cetera. Some surgeons are going to be, and then some that aren't. And I've personally seen big strokes that have been missed and almost incidentally found when a neurologist comes by and happens to see, or a family member comes by and happens to see a patient and the family member knows a neurologist. So I worry about the accuracy of the identification of stroke. I do know that it's been used by STS and that there's experience with this, but I really worry about, unless there's a systematic method for picking up strokes, that we could potentially miss it.
Okay. So you're saying there is no systematic method for picking up stroke?
Correct.
Okay. Any comments from anyone else?
This is Rich Prager. The only thing I would add to that, and I agree totally, is that there is a systematic method, but it's different everywhere, which is what complicates this more, whether it's the surgeon, who hopefully didn't miss it for 3 days, but perhaps did, versus the neurologist, versus the intensivist, and that is going to remain a major issue.
Okay. All righty.
I guess the difficult, issue for the committee is, does that variability in reporting negate the value of the measure?
And I would argue, actually, that the onus is on the proposer to clarify that it's not a problem.
So the question that seems open is, how big of a problem is it? Do we have any way of determining that?
Well, we have the data say it's between 1% and 7.5%.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we know we have a statistical issue here.
Right.
But that's as far as I can support the question. I can answer the question.
Okay.
And would it be of help if I went to one of our large customers who's using this measure and to see if they've had any errors given to them in the use of this measure?
I'm not sure they'd know.
Yeah, I mean, I almost think you have to do like a thorough evaluation or a study, where you have a systematic evaluation done by somebody unbeknownst to, the physicians that are actually taking care of the patient to look at the accuracy of the documentation.
And that hasn't been done to date.
Right. So, and I think that that illness is required because of the potential for causing inaccurate reporting.
Okay. Any other comments from any other TAP members? Okay. Alrighty, then our last sub-criteria is 4E, the data collection strategy and implementation. How would you rank it, Dr. Prager and Dr. Kasson?
I gave it a C.
Okay. Dr. Kasson?
Yeah, I gave it a P here. Maybe it's because it's probably because of the same issues we just discussed.
Right. But being based on administrative data, it's fairly straightforward to do the data collection.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. So we've finished the sub-criteria for this measure as well. Any other comments from anybody?
This is Rich Prager. The only thing I would ask the developer and the group, and perhaps it goes to the steering committee, is in 2010, if we're really going to start looking at this more clearly, and as David Shaheen mentioned, with STS reviewing their specifications for the database, there are so many different techniques now in cardiac surgery. Some felt to have advantages over others in lessening the likelihood of stroke. I think if we're going to, let's just say a neurologist sees every patient after, that's not the issue. But to collect this without collecting some of that information, whether it was a beating heart operation, a cross clamp operation, whether the aorta was assessed, that would really help in measures such as this, I believe, for the future.
Okay. Certainly put that as a comment. And I think our developers have heard it. Okay. Any other comments on either of these measures?
Can I just briefly ask, you probably already discussed this, your thoughts on the need for a risk adjustment model?
Yeah, we did discuss that, and I think that most of the members of the TAP agreed with you that this is a measure that should be risk-adjusted.
Okay, great.
What I'm going to do is put the summary of this together. There were several members of the TAP who couldn't join us today, so I want to be sure they have a chance to review before we finalize these as a product of the entire group. So I'll try and get these out. You should be receiving from us the summary of your comments and the evaluation from the measures we did on January 19th. We should be sending those out probably first thing next week. And please feel free to clarify or enlarge any of the comments. We tried to capture what you said, and I've been poring over your transcript. Perhaps there may be things you'll want to add, and please feel free to do so. So we'll be sending this out in early next week as well for you to review. These measures are going to be going to the steering committee. We have so many measures for the steering committee to address in their meeting in April that we're breaking them into two groups, and this looks to be a part of the group of measures we're going to try and do ahead of so that we can have a first group go through the process a little bit ahead of the second group, just to make it easier on our audiences and not be handing them large numbers of measures all at once. So we're going to be finalizing these evaluation criteria with you over the next week to 10 days so that we can then forward them on to the steering committee. This group still has several measures to evaluate. You had the largest group of measures in this topic area. I believe the next conference call is scheduled, is it February 16th? I just don't have it in front of me. But essentially, we'll be going through two measures on that call similarly as we've done today. Thank you to the reviewers who looked over everything and sent us your preliminary review. I think that was very helpful in us understanding what we were looking for and needing to discuss over the call today. And I think that I don't have anything more from NQF. Any comments from any of our audience members, if you will? Joyce Lee, are you still with us? Anything you'd like to comment on? Or anyone else?
No, just thank you. And then we will need to look into that beta blocker issue.
Right.
So I don't think the non-cardiac surgery issue is relevant.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything from you, Joyce? Was there any,
no,
were there any other public audience members listening in?
Yeah, Joel Harder at Society of Cardiovascular Angiography and Intervention.
Hi, Joel. Did you want to say anything?
I did want to mention that the CARE registry does have 30-day neurologic follow-up in a registry, and it's been a big success, so it's doable.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much.
If there's nothing else, and I think everybody have a nice weekend. Thank you very much. We'll see you on the next call.